Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, host and reporter for KQED's Radio's California Report and your moderator for today's program. And now it's time to introduce our guest. In November of 2011, Ross Mercurimi was elected sheriff of San Francisco after serving 7 years on the Board of Supervisors. As supervisor, Mercurimi supported police reforms, including community policing. And before getting elected to the board, he graduated from the San Francisco Police Academy and also served 9 years as an investigator with the San Francisco District Attorney's Office. In his campaign for sheriff last year, Mercurimi ran as a progressive with support from the outgoing sheriff, Michael Hennessy. But just before his swearing in, Mercurimi bruised his wife's arm during a domestic dispute. He was charged with 3 misdemeanors, including domestic violence battery, and later pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge of false imprisonment. Mayor Ed Lee suspended him without pay and asked that the city's Ethics Commission investigate. In August, the commission found that Mercurimi committed official misconduct and recommended he be removed from office. But in October, the Board of Supervisors failed to get the 9 votes needed to accept that recommendation, and Mercurimi returned to office with back pay. As sheriff, Mercurimi runs a department that oversees the county jails at a time when counties are taking more responsibility for low-level offenders and parole violators under Governor Brown's so-called realignment of criminal justice. We're going to begin with a short opening statement from Sheriff Mercurimi, and then, as I said, we'll take some questions. Please welcome Ross Mercurimi.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you. Good evening. I would like to thank the Commonwealth Club for extending the invitation to me. I have always been fond of the Commonwealth Club programming and congratulate them on their 109 years of providing such a thought-provoking public service and educational forum. And Scott Schaefer, who I've known for a long time, for your smart, investigative, measured journalism on the airwaves. That's just to butter you up, Scott. So,
it's not going to work.
It's nice to see this crowd. Thank you. It's nice to see this crowd, of course, on a Thanksgiving week. Yesterday, Monday, November 19th, I was privileged, honored, to be at San Quentin, where I was joined by a number of people from my staff in the Sheriff's Department, where we joined the chief of San Francisco's Adult Probation Department and a number of people from her staff, where we sat in the warden's conference room of San Quentin, met with the warden, a sizable representation of his staff, representatives from the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, CDCR from the state, and others. It was a sizable meeting, and it was a photogenic moment. The reason for the meeting was that we were putting the finishing touches on a project that has never occurred before in the state of California and not in San Francisco. And what might seem commonplace to people about the idea and the project I'm about to reveal to you is something that the state and this country has been slow to recognize in its efforts to try to tackle recidivism or high repeat offender rates in a meaningful way. When I ran for sheriff and when I first came into office, when I actively served earlier this year, I wanted to move forward in joint collaboration with our local and state criminal justice partners. Realignment was certainly instigating this level of cooperation if those choose to do so. And earlier this year, we began the idea of forming what is known as a reentry pod. And a reentry pod that I am proud to see the way that the Adult Probation Department in San Francisco has continued to nurture the idea, and others locally have done as well, would be that instead of the sequential method of how routinely law enforcement and the criminal justice system incarcerate somebody, they finish their time and then hand them off to parole or probation, that they then are more inclined to recidivate in a very quick period of time, repeat their offenses. What makes this innovative and unfamiliar, but hopefully becomes a norm for how law enforcement and criminal justice acts from here on, is that there is that further collaboration between members of the local criminal justice system. We are held accountable by adult probation or parole, and in return, we do the same of them, so that when somebody's incarcerated, that they are shepherded while they are incarcerated in a very lasered-like focus of a continuum of care, so that when they're released from incarceration in a post-custody climate, where in the first 6 months of their release, where the highest propensity of repeating their offenses occurs, that won't happen, hopefully, if our schematic works out well. Now, for San Francisco, we're no stranger, I think, to advancing forward-thinking ideas. But when you work with the state or work with the feds, bureaucracies move a little bit different pace. And so upon exiting this meeting, and I'm debriefing with a few people, you know, we're sort of recalling what this year has been like in terms of getting to the place of us being able to unveil, and hopefully soon formally unveil, what the notion of a reentry pod means and its meaning, I think, to the criminal justice system and ultimately to the citizenry. And then, of course, it's hard to talk about the year in delinking that from the personal ordeal that me, my family, and the whole public has certainly been exposed to. Because it was a year ago, in the month of November, what happened to be one of the happiest months of my life, aside from my wife, Ileana, giving birth to our son, Theo. What occurred last November was that I was honored enough by the people of San Francisco to be elected sheriff. And for me, that honor was more than I think I can put into words, because I was succeeding a man who, to me, not only was I a fan of, but to me really lives an iconic status, and that is Sheriff Mike Hennessy. A prodigious reformer. He was never a peace officer. I was a peace officer, had the credential, yet elected 8 consecutive times, where he was able to defy, I think, even the most stiff of bureaucracies, but certainly in the criminal justice system, one that is most resistant to liberal thought. Hennessy, in a very kind of low-key way, that was his style, something I should learn a little more, he was able to really innovate, and his administration innovate the kind of programs that really today, even after his retirement of 32 years, counties in California and around the country are just now picking up on this. And so when I was elected, transitioning from the Board of Supervisors after serving 7 years and really working my butt off for my district, because I was known as a bit of a workaholic, but also in criminal justice and public safety issues, I spent an intense amount of time in transitioning to become the sheriff from that November and December. It was a proud moment. Here's my family. I'm the next sheriff, elected citywide. It was a spirited campaign, and we were prepping ourselves for a new era of following and building on the Mike Hennessy outlook. And then life imploded. Stupidly, wrongly, very wrong, I acted in a way that I should have never acted. I overreacted to an intense argument that my wife and I were having out of fear and insecurity that I have about when they travel to Venezuela, her home country, with our son. And what I did was something that I wish that I would be able to undo, and that's just what happened. And forever we'll be sorry to my family and to all of you who really, I think, have escorted me along the way of the big and very profile dissection of what had happened. It was a tough year, being forced separated from my wife and son, a separation that neither my wife nor I had asked for, but crushing when I wasn't able to see Theo, my boy, our son. And that gave me an intense amount of time for reflection, intense amount of time for soul searching. There were friends amongst you in the audience here and others who, if it wasn't, I think, for some of the love and support and the real sort of like sobering, like, you know, you got to reconcile with this in many ways. I'm not so sure if I would have navigated those low points, but I did. And I did so in ways where I also try to put myself in the shoes of even my biggest critics, such as members of the domestic violence community, because it was such an awkward, adversarial relationship that seemed to have just emerged, because before this incident that happened with my wife on December 31st, I was a very outspoken ally. 7 years on the Budget Committee of the Board of Supervisors, chair of the city's Public Safety Committee, I wouldn't accept the fact that when there would be budget cuts in the worst intense times of during the Gavin Newsom administration and due to the economy imploding in the United States and its effects trickling to San Francisco, that in the ADVAC process, I would still want to be the go-to guy for dollars to be repleted for DV programs that were cut. And so I could not, it would be even hard to explain just how clumsy I felt that I did not correct missteps early on. It's lunacy to think that anyone would ever believe domestic violence is a private family matter. It's not. And I was stupid for not clarifying that. I was also aghast when DV advocates, courageous advocates, then would come to my hearings and speak their mind, that I would try to think of, if it wasn't me that was on the receiving end and another politician, would I be so considerate of what they were going through? And what they did was advocating for something that I do understand, but at the same time, what I did campaign for and what I hold true to, not just in the reflection of what personally I've gone through, but also in my outlook of what I want to do as sheriff. And that is be smart on public safety and recognize the principle of the power of redemption. Because I honestly believe that the conversation that we had, like at San Quentin, and what I believe that we will embark on moving forward in having to apply what realignment means to a city and county like San Francisco, means that what we have not tackled for so many years is the high repeat offender rates. When we throw $500 million to a San Francisco Police Department budget for first response to try to ensure and shore up threats to public safety, any one of your public safety, but then we look at the sort of the fractional application of dollars towards rehabilitation and effective reentry, then it is important and incumbent upon us to laser in on that particular need. So in the San Francisco Sheriff's Department, you know, it is something that Mike Kennessy made famous, that it's more than just about managing the 6 county jails, or certainly managing the protection of government buildings like City Hall or San Francisco General, Laguna Honda, or having a warrant service bureau where we track down fugitives both locally and Bay Area, or where the Sheriff's Department provides 20 rehabilitative programs and its modalities both for in-custody and post-custody, where we have an eviction, where we do all the evictions in San Francisco. I mean, the Sheriff's Department is more than just about corrections. A progressive, forward-thinking Sheriff's Department is about complementing the needs of public safety, but it's about improving lives so that those who come through that are booked in the Sheriff's Department, we don't see them again. And so when I travel in the jail system and I talk to, as I just did today in our properties in San Bruno, and I talk to those who are incarcerated, and I speak one-on-one with them, and I have lunch with them, I ask them, have you been here before? Tell me what your story is. Where did you go wrong, and where can we get better? Where can we improve ourselves? That's the level of dialogue that then needs to be put into a practice and strategy, institutionalized, where we're held accountable, not just based on whether murder is down or up or crime is down or up, but based on the fact, are we improving lives? And that is a new metric that I really don't think has been well introduced in the state of California, but due to prisoner realignment, I believe that now that deflects the responsibility onto us should we elect to take that responsibility. And as I conclude my remarks, because I know there's a lot of questions, that San Francisco is poised to really lead and continue to lead the state and the country. One is we're one of the only counties in the whole state that has undercrowding in its county jail system. Our capacity is 2,400. At count today, we're just a click under 1,600. And so it is evident in the fact that both diversion and rehabilitation and reentry, as a result of this much more insisted upon collaborative model between district attorney, public defender, sheriff, adult juvenile probation, mayor's office, board of supervisors, others within the CBO family, learning from those who've been formerly incarcerated, and you put them in the soup, in the big soup, so that we're able then to articulate both vision and practical programmatic approach so that we're able to say, hey, we are really doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing. Crime is down because most of the crime that we're seeing is not new criminals, it's repeat offenders. And if crime is down, that means that we're getting the double bang of being able to help improve society from outside the jail cell and from within. Thank you very much.
Well, Sheriff, I want to try to balance the questions between some of the issues you've raised around realignment and reducing recidivism and some of the other personal legal issues, and I'll try to strike that balance. And I know people in the audience have questions looking at these on both as well. It's been, what, 5 weeks or so since you've been back?
That's right.
At work? And there still seems to be a cloud over the office. The mayor isn't talking to you. You wrote a letter. He didn't respond. The DA is trying to rein in your authority. There's talk of a recall. Your successor, Christina Loggi, who voted to reinstate you, was not elected in the past election. And so I'm trying to get a sense of, you know, why do you think it's so hard for the city to move on?
I don't know if it's the city per se, except I think that there are people who have different motivations. And in order to fulfill those motivations, they try to fan the flames. It was important to me that even arriving at the conclusion of this process of whether I would be reinstated or not, that the first thing I did on the night of the Board of Supervisors is I called the interim sheriff, who I understood was clearing out her desk, and I said, don't. I want to sit down with you for a few days, and I want to have a very thorough transition. And I immediately fired off a letter to the mayor, and I said, in the spirit of reconciliation, I really would like to meet with you and discuss how we do move forward. I also had recused myself upon my official reinstatement in the office from any programs that have to do with domestic violence, just in anticipation that was probably the sensible thing to do. But that has now been distorted in such an inflated way, which I'm more than happy to talk with you about, that I really want us to move forward. And so I hold my ground, and the more I hold my ground, I think sometimes that really infuriates those who want to wield their power for a different outcome.
So what you're saying, I think, is that the mayor, the DA, and others who are fanning the flames, as you say, have some other agenda other than what they're saying. So, like, what do you think that is?
Well, I wasn't on their team to begin with when I ran last year. I mean, I was not. I wasn't on their team. You know, it's interesting. Some people...
Did Ed Lee, was he involved in the sheriff's race? I don't...
No, I don't believe D.A. Gascon was either, but as a supervisor, I did not advocate for Mr. Lee as the interim mayor. So you know, created kind of a tonal quality that I just don't look back. I look ahead if we're not on the same team, per se. And I thought the Chronicle, to be honest with you, after the last November election, It's typical courtesy of the paper of record that recognizes the victors in election. And so in their editorial, I remember this November 2011, that congratulations, Ed Lee Mayor, congratulations, George Gascon, DA, and that left me out completely. And this is before December 31st of the incident between Eliana and I. So I just knew that this was a signal of things to come.
An omen. You know, I was thinking, you know, we've all started new jobs as adults, and I was thinking, you know, here you are under the best of circumstances. You're walking into a situation where 94% of the deputy sheriffs have voted to endorse the other guy, Paul Miyamoto. You've got a situation where you're replacing a guy who was very well liked, had big shoes to fill. Mike Hennessy was there forever, ran by all accounts a great department, was never challenged, you know, in any election. That's under the best of circumstances, that's a tough act to follow. But coming in under those circumstances and the legal cloud, I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, I'm dealing with it, and I was doing so related to your question about the climate. Politically speaking, no talent where I see it. I promoted then Captain Miyamoto to be my assistant sheriff, the number three in the office, and that was a signal of respect as well to the peace officers and the deputy sheriffs. Keep in mind that Mike Hennessy had run 8 consecutive times, and he rarely ever got their endorsement either. So the very, very popular sheriff who oversaw 99% of the employment of this 1,000-plus person staff never endorsed him when he ran for sheriff, almost never. So this is a landscape that, while it might seem a little bit, a little bit sort of adversarial, it's not. It's more commonplace, I think, especially in law enforcement. And what I did was simply do what I can, with all sincerity, I'm an honest talker, about representing the interest of our peace officers in the deputy sheriff's department, and gleaning from my experience as a peace officer and somebody who's had some military experience too as a vet. That resonates. And then we get into the brass tacks of what it is that I can do for them.
And did you get a sense that there was resistance? I mean, how...
There's always resistance.
But how much did you feel you needed to say some of the things you said here tonight about what you had been through to them, to your employees?
Oh, well, I try to keep them very much posted and informed, but we're a paramilitary culture. Law enforcement is, and it's a chain of command. And so you respect sort of the regiment of how information is projected. And I believe that, you know, why I would go to the jails and go to their musters where they congregate before their three shifts. I would do absolutely everything possible to be there to answer questions and be accessible. And that will be my administration, where I will be, as people knew me as a supervisor, sometimes to a fault, maybe a little too hands-on, but that's my style. I'm very hands-on, but I want to delegate and want to make sure that the people in our department grow.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question about the domestic violence groups that have been so vocal in opposing you and lobbying the board to not to reinstate you, and now participating in discussions about a recall. What is it, as you said, you have a relationship with them going back to before your election as sheriff. What is your sense of I don't want to say what their issue is, because that's clear, but why do you think why have they gone after you with the intensity that they have?
Well, I can't speak about the intensity, but it, going after me was one thing. Dismissing my wife was something else. And I think that it was important that in the equation of depicting what has happened and how it's affected our lives, Ileana, my sons, my wife, and the lives of everybody else who has accompanied this whole story, she was very resistant to that as well, and I was, because I think that there was just a level of disrespect that was missing in this conversation, and maybe that might be a foreign expectation for something like this, but it just seems so antagonistic, and that level of intensity seems to continue to compound itself. But for me, quite frankly, It's counterintuitive. I can be the most incredible advocate in making sure that we do everything we can to eradicate domestic violence and violence in communities. And I believe that as sheriff, that I can continue to help influence and help speak out for the need that those who've ever offended never offend again. And that when I went into the jails and spoke to people who've come up to me that are incarcerated, they have said that they don't ever want to be in that position again, and I want to help them.
Yeah. As you said, your wife was pretty adamant that she didn't want this case to move forward. And I'm just wondering what role you, when there is a spouse or a partner who is in that situation, and it may be different circumstances, but she or he is saying, you know, I don't want you to pursue this, drop it. What should the role of, you know, how should that be resolved with law enforcement? Because as you know, historically, the police have basically walked away, or the DA has walked away when that was the case, when the spouse, the husband, the wife, wouldn't cooperate.
Well, recanting is something that we want to discourage completely, but in this particular case, it was third party. It was a third party projection of what happened and a huge distortion of what happened. Even when Ileana had informed me about a video and about her conversation with the neighbor, my immediate response, and this came out in the ethics deliberations, is we cannot unring this bell and we have to let the process unfold. I mean, despite the fact I was on the receiving end of it, I felt that the integrity of the process and my belief in San Francisco's system needed to remain intact, as painful and hurtful as it was. So I asked that the police and the district attorney and organizations that work with them do everything they can to strengthen, I think, victim resolve. But at the same time, on the receiving end, we must do a better job in San Francisco of reunifying families. Because at the charge of really trying to get the win in the criminal process, families now have become a complete casualty when they don't have the resourcefulness or the wherewithal to survive or endure a process like that. I know because I asked. I didn't know if it was just unique to our experience, but it was unique to, I think, experiences by many that I became in contact with.
You said in your remarks, you know, coming back to that day, the 31st of December, there was an argument about her going back to Venezuela with Theo, your son. And you said, and I can't remember the exact phrase you used, but it was that discussions like that bring out a kind of fear in you.
And insecurity.
Insecurity. Yeah, what's that about?
Well, it's about what I've been going to therapy about. It's and not mandated, but something that I chose to do the week that it actually occurred. and it was my, I was wrong because we'd been talking about going to couples counseling, which we did not. I procrastinated. I became too monofocused on work and campaign. But in that counseling, becoming a father and having a family that travels and it happens to actually relate to a feeling of abandonment in my own experience as a child. But it was something that I needed to work out and work through. And that was a projection that I'm dealing with.
Yeah. I think your parents were divorced when you were five. Is that what you're referring to?
Wow, I didn't know we were getting this deep.
I know it's your private audience, it's awkward, but I've been listening to Fresh Air too much, I guess.
Yeah, as well. Yes, Scott, that's correct.
No, I mean, my own parents separated when I was about that age, and so, you know, I understand. You know,
and there were some cultural issues, too. My parents met young, an Iranian Muslim father, and my mother was not, and come from Russian Jewish ancestry on her side, and it was surviving in two different cultures as I would shuttle back and forth between both of them.
Yeah. You, as part of the plea that you did on the one charge of false imprisonment, you've been going to an anti-violence class for, I think, is it a year, I think?
It is. It's 52 weeks.
Yeah,
that's right.
What have you learned in that about yourself?
More to what I just spoke about, but talking about these things with others in a class, all men, some repeat offenders, and it's not easy to share, but sharing is done a lot. And it's a question of me, I think, learning to about dealing with my insecurities of losing something in my life and being detached in a way where it doesn't affect my need to want to control in a way that is wrong.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, those classes are not anonymous, but I mean, they're confidential and all that. Has it been awkward for you going into a class like this where everyone has been reading about it in the newspaper?
Oh, I'm spotted everywhere, inside and out. It's Phil Matera just asked me this the other day, and it's a strange fame. I mean, in some ways, I really do appreciate, though, the well wishes and support I get wherever I travel in San Francisco. And there's a curiosity and an interest, but I'm just like everybody else in those classes. There's no breaks, and if anything, I try to listen to them, and I know they try to listen to me when it's our turn to speak and engage. I think it's very fulfilling. It is an example, I think, of one of the real bright spots of what San Francisco has been doing in its resolve to stop the violence, in our city, and that's why some of the programs in San Francisco, both in custody and post-custody, are award-winning programs.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the sort of the heart of the concern that the DA has expressed and some of the domestic violence groups have expressed is that you may, having gone through this experience, have a conflict of some kind. It could be that you overreact to an issue of domestic violence, or that you just view it differently in some way, either because you're compensating or whatever it might be, that the situation has changed you in a way that you shouldn't deal with these issues because you can't be objective.
Well, it's wrong on at every aspect. One, if it changes me for the better. That's why I think philosophically people need to understand the way that we would integrate a concept of what makes us, what makes us effective in relating to those who have offended, who have done wrong, and who can do better. But what they're getting wrong is the fact that rarely does any matter related to a program or policy of domestic violence reach the desk of sheriff. As I said earlier, in our department of over 1,000 people, there is a chain of command, and as I spoke with my predecessor, Mike Hennessy, he said maybe in a given year, one or two times, whether it's a disciplinary matter or policy related. In this case, that's why it was so doable for me to recuse myself, so that there would be no appearance and no possibility of risk of any conflict of interest.
I just want to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is San Francisco Sheriff Ross Mercurimi, who's discussing his past, present, and future plans for the office. What are you going to do about the mayor? I mean, the mayor controls your budget. The mayor hasn't responded to your letter. The mayor has said hostile things in the press. How are you going to deal with that?
Well, I'll continue to send him love letters. I'm going to come at it in a way where I really want to build alliances. I'm no stranger to building uncommon alliances as a supervisor and as a community activist. The idea is about doing the work on behalf of the people, as I was elected to do, and I'm not going to retreat from that position. Now, I do find it awkward that we communicate through the Chronicle or the press. And I do find it awkward that he or the district attorney releases letters first to the press, and then I receive them in the mail afterwards, and I'm like, nobody informed me of this. But I think that this is where things get distorted. So, to this question, I think that it's best that we do meet. If he would like, I invite him to choose a venue that he would like, that I say that he should select, and I'll meet with him in public, and we'll have a public discussion, maybe in a forum like this, or in a domestic violence, organization or consortium of organizations, and let's have a conversation about this, because I believe he wants the same things as I want, and I think we have to sort of, bring it down to a more human level about how we move forward.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the issues facing the jail. I'm sure you're happy to talk about that. Recidivism rate was one of the big issues that you ran on as sheriff, and it was something you dealt with as supervisor.
True.
And we've now had about a year of this realignment where the counties are taking more responsibility for low-level offenders and now people getting out of prison who were in there for low, non-serious, non-violent, non-sexual offenses. And how is it that the population in the jail is it actually going down, or is it just below capacity?
No, it's below capacity, but we're seeing trend now. And that's what's been fascinating, is that the trend has been static at a level that surprises, I think, even criminologists who are watching San Francisco. It's unique to San Francisco in some ways. A couple things about the context of why we need to be really looking to realignment as an approach of tackling public safety concerns. One is, for the longest time, the repeat offender rate in the state of California has been hovering at 77-78% for violent criminal and nonviolent. In San Francisco, it's been at 65%. The reason why for that, in my opinion, is that it was Sheriff Mike Kennessy who really shouldered the burden in creating a more modern sheriff's department in post-custody and in-custody rehabilitation programs, but there's no way that a sheriff's department could shoulder that alone. So as a supervisor, and correctly as other elected leaders have recognized and what realignment has prompted, now adult probation is coming online to be a key partner in this relationship, which makes us fortified to tackle things that we haven't been fortified before. And there's now more of a harmony amongst the constellation of criminal justice partners, as I said, DA, police, sheriff, et cetera, in dealing with the kind of offenders that need to be incarcerated versus those that need to be diverted. Our diversion programs are growing in such a way that we're seeing a greater bang for our buck, because it costs about $50,000-$55,000 a year to incarcerate somebody. But if we put them through an alternative program, not incarcerated, it's a fraction of the cost. And we're beginning to see greater return for that approach.
As you know, the impetus for this, to a certain extent, was that the state prisons were bulging at the seams. The U.S. Supreme Court ordered the state to reduce the prison population. This is a big part of how the state, Governor Brown, sees his way to that reduced population. But some counties are concerned that basically the state is dumping its problems into the counties. And just the other day, Alameda County, I believe, was sued by a disability rights group for not having proper access for disabled inmates over there. And I'm just wondering if there's a concern among you and your other sheriffs that you talk to, that some of these lawsuits that plagued the state are going to start to be directed at the counties.
Well, there's a couple things that I think we should get ahead of the realities that might begin to plague other counties. But keep in reference that San Francisco sent fewer people to state prison, which is why fewer are coming back. The population that will come back through state realignment for the 2011-2012 is about 650, both through incarceration or through diversion of adult probation. Other counties were much more liberal in their policies, in sending them to the state prison, which is why they're now seeing large numbers returning back to their counties. And what's interesting that people should be cognizant of is that when you heard about, you know, the state prison industry and unions and others who were really talking about building more prisons, now that movement is shifting to local governments so that there is a greater building of jails and a greater building of prison-like systems in a municipal arena to accommodate the extra population that's coming back. That's where we're at the precipice of realignment. We don't want some counties going in the direction of what have been the bad mistakes on the state level. And even to take it further, frankly, I'd like to be a sheriff that builds less jail space. When I look at the prospect of when we are now about ready to demolish the Hall of Justice, which should have been demolished a long time ago, 850 Bryant, we have about 900 beds in that jail. I'd like to send a statement, but supported, I think, by the evidence that suggests that we don't need to replace it with a one-for-one bed jail. That I think the way the trends that are beginning to move in such a way that now it might be radical to some, but it's a direction that I want to support. That the blueprint and footprint of what future jails should look like need to put a greater emphasis on rehabilitation and reentry. It might be attached to incarceration, on a flash incarceration, those serving very quick sentences or short-term sentences beyond that, but begin to actually put money where their mouth is. Most often, in the criminal justice system, rehabilitation reentry programs were always the footnote or the afterthought. They never accompanied in the unison of development of what and how we're going to manage incarcerate an inmate population.
Yeah, even progressive law enforcement officials, DAs, sheriffs, have said that it's likely that, at least in the short term, when you're releasing more inmates, when there are fewer people on parole or they're on parole for shorter periods of time, that the crime rate's going to go up, that there's going to be more property crimes and perhaps other kinds of crime. You're hearing that anecdotally. I don't know what the numbers are like, but, you know, is that a concern, and how do you prevent that?
It's a conventional theory. There's something else that I talked about actually in my inaugural that bothered a lot of people in front of about 1,000 people at the Herbst Theater, and there's something unique to San Francisco and something that requires an hour-long program just to this theory alone. 59% of our jail population in San Francisco is African-American, and yet San Francisco is the city, the largest city in the United States with the fastest exodus of its black population. And so with the exodus of the black population, you'll begin to see, I think, a change in the demographic of what will be expected in the demography of our jail population. And public safety will be affected by that, too.
How so? What do you mean?
Well, I think that the out-migration of an African-American population should also be seen in the disproportionate sentencing. I think of African-Americans and Latinos, black and brown people that end up in our jail system and the state prison system. And that is the case. That is a case in trends of approach of how we've dealt with a large and sizable African-American population is also a harbinger of how that might be dealt with a growing Latino population, too.
Yeah. Well, as you can see, we've got more than a couple of questions here from the audience.
And That's great.
I'm going through the first bunch. And I want to begin by, the Commonwealth Club got an email question that was sent. Apparently several people signed a petition from the San Francisco chapter of the National Organization for Women requesting that we ask a question. So I'm going to ask this question from them. And it has to do with a model policy on domestic violence apparently supported by the International Association of the Chiefs of Police, the IACP. And the question is, the IACP model policy would preclude someone convicted of false imprisonment of his wife from being sheriff. Do you support the IACP model? Can you put the interests of San Franciscans before your own personal interests and adopt this policy established by the IACP?
I don't think that applies to misdemeanors or infractions. I'd like to know more about it, but I think that it does not. And to do something like that would then disqualify many peace officers, whether in San Francisco or throughout the state of California and the nation, who have been convicted of something very similar. So I'm not sure if that is completely thorough in its representation.
And they added that since reclaiming office, negotiations to adopt this model policy have been halted. The sheriff's office has left the table, although the SFPD continues to work on it.
I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. All right, here's another question from the audience. So what are the differences in the duties of the sheriff's department versus the police, and how does it play out with one department head elected and one not?
Well, the chief of police is appointed. His command staff is subordinate to the police commission and the chief executive of the city, the mayor. The sheriff is independently elected, and there is no commission on behalf of the sheriff's department. The police are the first responders, and of course that they are charged by our city and county charter, constitution, that they are the public safety responders. The sheriff's, as I said earlier and gave a quick sketch of what we do, manages the jails and the government buildings, on services of evictions and our warrant service of fugitives, many programs of both in custody and post custody, It's an extremely well-rounded department. The number of peace officers of the Sheriff's Department is 860, approximately. They are credentialed the exact same way as San Francisco Police Department officers. They're paid less. It is, I think, a question about when SFPD is staffed distressed sometimes, is there opportunity or need for deploying sheriffs? And there is, because when you've seen, like in the World Series events, that was wonderful in the pennant in the World Series, that there were the celebrations, and then there was the ruckuses, like fires and muni buses being tipped over. We deploy the Sheriff's Department to help out. Mutual aid is often called to us, where we respond, both locally or in the Bay Area. Our Sheriff's Department responds. We are really a very full-range kind of department with a lot of in our scope.
Yeah. When you were on the board, you had what some would say was a tense relationship with Gascon, who was then the police chief. You had supported community policing and more foot patrols. There was an issue about his speaking out about terrorists and, Middle Eastern folks, and you took offense to that, and as did many, and spoke out about it. Do you feel that the history between the two of you has something to do with the present?
It could. New York Times in January actually wrote a story about this, and I was surprised that the local press didn't pick up on it. But there was some engagement where when I was chair of the Public Safety Committee, the Board of Supervisors, and insisted on a level of attention by SFPD that was more community-driven. I think that successfully we've seen our ability to abate violent crime and reduce it significantly in key areas like some of the areas I used to represent work. And we were not of like mind on that.
Yeah. And you feel like it's payback in some way?
No, I don't. No, I look forward to working with the district attorney. I look forward to working with the mayor. I look forward to working with anybody where that if there was at any point, an adversarial kind of rapport, we can get past that and move forward. We have a lot of work to do on behalf of the city.
We have a couple of questions about guns. One is, when on duty, are you armed? Are you a good shot? And then a question about, how is the sheriff able to carry a weapon given that I think it's someone convicted of a felony, which you were not convicted of, is not allowed. You would have had to surrender your gun under.
Well, I surrender my weapons anyway. The sheriff is not required to wear a weapon. Mike Hennessy, as I said earlier, was never a peace officer. In fact, they were, in spite of Mike Hennessy being elected, they changed the law so that if Mike Hennessy were to ever run again for sheriff, he would not be able to. But the fact that he ran 8 consecutive times and won without any break, he was able to maintain a sheriff, but that would be the end of ever electing somebody like a Mike Hennessy. And he had his own gun permit. Once in a while, he may have carried it, but it is not routine for the sheriff to do that. And yes, when I used to carry a weapon, when I worked for the district attorney's office, I was a decent shot. And
you had to use it?
No. I think it's a badge of honor when you don't have to use your weapon.
All right, let's see. We hear reports about sheriffs who vow to stop foreclosures and evictions. What is your plan to address evictions and foreclosures in San Francisco?
This is an important issue because people are desperate for answers, and government, I think, has been slow to respond. When I was a supervisor, when the foreclosure crisis began to engulf everywhere in the country and then began to seep into San Francisco, I think that local government was really sort of bereft of any kind of meaningful response to this reality. State government was too. Then I saw 4 sheriffs around the country say they're going to stop evicting. So I called them up. And I want to know, how can you do that? Because I want to understand how you can do that. And then I called Mike Hennessy, sheriff at the time. Can you do that? Really? Because Richard Hengisto, who was sheriff, actually made a name for himself by refusing to evict in the I Hotel, which put him in jail for 5 days. Another convicted sheriff. And it turned out that as I learned more as an exiting supervisor to be then candidate sheriff and then sheriff, that all those sheriffs I spoke to, the several around the country, within 2 to 3 weeks of their declaration of not to evict, they end up returning back to evictions. Evictions, intrinsically, are court-ordered requirements. Sheriff has to carry them out. But what we find ourselves, I think, insufficiently or ill-equipped is that we don't know how to qualify of a bad foreclosure or a legitimate foreclosure. So evictions resulting from foreclosures are now high on my radar, where I'm now reforming our internal process so that it is on the plaintiff or the bank that when they go to a court order and ask for eviction, we want more documentation, and I'll do this adding penalty under perjury. Because I don't like the fact that we're evicting people, especially seniors or those disabled or families with children, unless we have some kind of check and balance. And there's nothing built into the local government that looks at that. So we're the last, we're essentially the last straw.
Are any other law enforcement agencies involved in that?
No. In fact, thanks to my predecessor, we're the only county that has the eviction assistance unit. And it's staffed by one person and kind of one part-time person. And based on the volume, a sheriff next to the next budget cycle, you know, that I'm hopefully me and my new friend merely, we increase our budget for eviction assistance, because what they do is they don't evict, they actually go in a caseworker kind of way to actually prepare the person that they are in this jeopardy, and we want to help them so that they can rebound. Now, no sheriff's department does this. In the state except ours, and none, I think, in the United States, but they're picking up on this model. Mm-hmm. But we're just really ill-staffed for this, yeah. Not well-staffed.
Coming back to the mayor, is there anyone you've asked to intercede on your behalf, someone who knows him well, someone you're close to, who's, you know, tried to open that door?
Yes, I have.
Can you talk about that?
No.
It was not successful, I take it.
No, I mean, everybody has their own process, right? I know this word well now. So everybody has that, and I respect that. But again, we have work to do, you know, and I'll continue to respond and hold, I think, what I think is principle to the advancement of law enforcement, public safety, and the sheriff's department on behalf of the people and those that we manage inside the jails and through programs. But, you know, the door is open, and I'll do whatever I can.
Yeah. Here's a question about Eliana, your wife. Where is she? And, you know, I just thinking about a relationship, what you have been through. I mean, a relationship is based on trust, in part. And I just can't imagine working through what the two of you went through, given what happened with the neighbor and the videotape. I mean, how does that work?
You have to know my wife. We're strong, resilient, and when we were apart, the amazing thing is when we came back together and sharing the notes that we weren't able to share because of the forced separation, one of the first things she said to me was, why the hell did you plea? It's the first, literally one of the first things she said to me. I had no idea she didn't want me to.
She wanted you to fight it.
She did, completely. And I wanted to... I was so feeling desperate of being separated from my wife and son, and then seeing the level of impact in the way that this was playing itself in the public, I thought it was the best thing to do to move forward. But we're strong. We're very strong because I think she felt that people weren't listening to her, and really to this day, Mayor Lee never had spoken to my wife. Police never have spoken to my wife to this very day. So there was so much projection that I think she felt just insistent that she be heard. And I think we found a strength in each other that we obviously had not been tested before.
Mm-hmm. Did she go back? She went back.
Oh, she's in Venezuela right now. She'll be back soon.
With Theo?
Yes. In fact, I just talked to him right before I got here. I have, when she does go back for work periodically, you know, we have a regiment where I speak with them by Skype or by phone, but with my son, they are now 3.5 hours difference, time difference. Chavez put it on the half hour when he came in office, the time change. that I read stories to him before he goes to bed, or hopefully earlier. And I have this diet, this menu of books I pick out and alternate them. And it's great. He's completely fluent in Spanish, too.
It's got to be tough, though.
It's crushing. It was crushing. Now it's not. We have something to look forward to. But being apart, I was on my knees. For my son?
I want to ask a different question, if that's okay.
Sure.
It's sort of the elephant in the room, I guess. But when you run for office, you know, everything's on the table. You know, there is very little privacy anymore. We've seen that with the CIA director, from the CIA director on down. Is that something you're willing to live with?
I think elected officials deserve to be held to a higher standard. I agree. I do. In that level of transparency, I'm not going to make excuses in that regard. And I've always believed in 1999, I ran the campaign for having sunshine, the sunshine laws in San Francisco, which made our city to have the strongest local Freedom of Information Act. It was a good band of people that we were able to succeed in that campaign, and I believe in that principle. But the level of sort of mean-spiritedness that occurs, that's a tonal quality that, you know, does not have to always be the tool that demands that level of transparency.
I wonder if you feel that what transpired at the board contributed in any way to, meaning the vote to reinstate you, contributed to the, you know, sort of splintering, fracturing of the progressive coalition. Eric Marr did not support you. Christina Loggi was not elected. What are your thoughts about that?
No, I don't think it did. I think that there's been precipitous decline of, I think, progressives and their influence in City Hall for some years now. I don't subscribe to the analysis that Christina Loggi, because she voted for me, it's too simplified. Being the supervisor of District 5 7 years, and I was reelected as supervisor with 78% of the vote, I know the district very, very well. And Christina, who I think was a really good choice by Ed Lee, by the way, to appoint after I moved up to sheriff, I think what surprised some people was the fact that of her rapport with the mayor and not be more independent. Yeah. So that was affecting her, especially in the eyes of arbiters like the Bay Guardian. And that happened all before, in the lack of endorsement, that happened all before the vote of my reinstatement.
Yeah. I do want to give audience members a chance to ask a verbal question if you'd like. If you'd like to do that, feel free to line up there behind the microphone. Another audience question, and you've alluded to some of this, but what are your plans to restore the relationship with the domestic violence community?
Well, let me use this forum to suggest I'll listen. Invite me to any venue of any choice, and I'll just sit there and listen and do everything I possibly can in order to restore your trust. It's been a hard year for us all, and I want to do whatever I can possibly to help move us forward and be the kind of ally I was before and even better. And there's one thing on that note. I noticed it a few times that some of the deliberations, like the ethics deliberations, and I was speaking to this in my opening remarks. Again, some of the people who were on the opposite side of the DV community who were really insistent about my removal in a way that I think that they were not respected by some members in the audience. And I didn't like it. And it deviates from the debate or the content that I think was being shared. And nobody deserved any level of disrespect. And from the DV community, I think it's courageous of any women, any men who would come up and share their experiences of trauma and pain, even if we may not see on the same side of what an outcome is, at least regarding my case. I still respect, I think, their voice.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Sheriff, you said that frequently you have lunch with the inmates. I wondered if you also have lunch with the female inmates, and what kind of feedback do you get from them about your situation? Thank you, sir.
Our women population is low, but I have had meals with women in our Women's Resource Center, which is a wonderful institution that is on Bryant Street near 7th. And it's with those who are formerly incarcerated and some very recently formerly incarcerated. And what's exciting over that lunch that we had is us discussing as those who had experience of being incarcerated with the Adult Probation Department about what are we going to do to be more gender responsive, meaning to women in this age of realignment. And I have to tell you, I was so uplifted by the conversation and by our fortitude to say, this is what we're going to do in order to institute the kind of reforms. And hearing their feedback really made me very proud. And some women came up to me afterwards personally and spoke to me about they wanted me to hold strong, hold steady, and they were very glad that I was back as sheriff.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
During your first week back in office, you registered 400 inmates to vote. This was a sign of respect for inmates. Are there other initiatives in the works so that peers can support and empower one another in preparation for reentry?
Well, I personally didn't do the registration, but I endorse the very vibrant efforts that our Prison Legal Services and others who really fan out in the jails in a very organized and effective way. And we have the highest, in that 400 represents what has happened in years before, and that is we have the highest voter-registered incarcerated population in the state of California, and one of the highest, I believe, if not the highest in the United States. As a matter of fact, our precinct, I mean, we're not a precinct officially, but the voter turnout is better than in the wealthiest district in San Francisco. And it's interesting in its contrast, and I will continue to really encourage that level of participation. And it's not just about registering to vote and voting. We encourage campaigns, and it doesn't matter if I agree or disagree, to bring all the material to the jails, and then we distribute the material to all the inmates. And I was just there earlier today because we're kind of beefing up our library in our San Bruno property in the jail, and some of the inmates who were there said, thank you very much for bringing the campaign material to us. We found it very informative, and we made our choices, and there you go.
Okay, we have time for just one more question, and it'll be yours.
You mentioned before about District 5 and Christina Loggi not getting reelected. I wonder what you do think that means, that London Breed, who's considered more moderate.
Oh, I know London. Elected. I think London is one. I think she's one of the most charming people I have ever worked with, and I've worked with her for many, many years. And she comes from the community of the Fillmore. We call it the Fillmore, Western Edition. And I think she'll do her best to try to represent everybody. I do. It is... maybe more from a more moderate perspective, and that time will only tell in the votes that come out. But I think that is what people anticipate. But she's a great people person, and I think that goes a long way in being a supervisor.
All right, thank you. And if you could join me in thanking Sheriff Ross Mercurimi for being here today. Thanks also to our audiences here and on television and radio and the Internet. I'm Scott Schaefer, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.